Welcome to the Soulcast. I'm not gonna give this episode a number because it's not a long form interview with someone. It's actually a long form interview with myself. Basically, people have submitted a whole bunch of questions online over the past few days, and I'm just gonna do a kind of special solo episode where I just answer these questions. As many people know, I just launched a Patreon to fund the Soulcast. So this is a shout out to the people who subscribe to this and listen to this and get anything out of it. If you want to support this project, there's a lot more I want to do with it next year. I want to do it more frequently. I want to do it more regularly. I want to expand it in new ways. I have a lot of ideas. I'm kind of keeping them to myself because I don't want to get ahead of myself. But, you know, I'm having a baby next year, so I'm trying to figure out how I can actually put more energy into doing the shit I give a fuck about and less energy in all the bullshit hustling stuff that I've been doing, which is cool. You know, I like touring. I like designing t-shirts and shit, but really I just want to focus on the work. And so hopefully by launching this Patreon, I can get to focusing on the actual work that I really want to do. Next couple podcasts I have lined up are really dope. Some of them might not happen, but the next few episodes I'll be interviewing DJ Payne One. I'll be interviewing Sonia Kennebec from 10 Forward Films, who recently made this drone documentary called National Bird. I'll be interviewing one of the people from Tarnak, one of the main folks behind that project, and we'll be talking about what the lessons are from the project in Tarnak. Also be talking with some of my Antifa homies from Antifa Live in Greece. I have a whole bunch of other ones that are just kind of waiting after that, and I want to fucking triple down on this shit, because shit's fucked up in the world right now, and, you know, we need projects like this. So if you're into supporting the podcast, you know, check out my Patreon. It's patreon.com/SOLEONE. Again, that Patreon is patreon.com/SOLEONE. And if you wanna support this project and enable me to do more with it, you know, fuck with it. You can support it for $2 a month or $1,000 a month. Doesn't matter. It does matter. Anything is awesome. Just hustling over here. I don't know what else. Oh, and also there's a musical component to it. Tons of, like, limited 7-inch stuff, a song of the month. You know, there's a bunch of, like, every month I'm going to release a new track. You know, sometimes it might be, like, experimental man's best friend kind of stuff. It might be collaborations. It might be Nuclear Winter tracks. And I'm just trying to mix it up. So if you're into my music, too, you're going to get a bunch of music shit out of it, depending on where you're backing. You know, there's a 7-inch, super rare 7-inch subscription where you can, you know, for I think $30 a month, you can get a one of 25 limited vinyls, which I think is pretty cool, picture discs. But yeah, okay, let's just move forward and dig into these questions. These were all submitted online this week, and they're not in any order. I just am answering them in the order that I got them. So let's see how this goes. First question is from Sam Hollers. Top 10 books you or people from the Soulcast would recommend in a list of resources for those of us who are just getting started in activism would be awesome. I jumped in first and hit hard, and there's not a whole lot of local support near me at all. Not that I've been able to find, anyhow. I'm not interested in saving the pound puppies and shit like that. Not that it isn't a worthy cause, but because there's way more serious shit that needs handled. You know, as a vegan, I would say, let's not equivocate here. You know, pound puppies, fuck, you know, everyone deserves to live. All beings on Earth deserve a chance at survival. But, you know, so, but here, I understand the point. I'm a vegan, but I don't do a lot of vegan activism. Most of the work I do is based around anti-police stuff or anti-capitalist stuff. So top 10 books you or people from the Soulcast would recommend. Anytime anybody asks me about books, the first book I always say, it's not a political book, but it's Hyperion by Dan Simmons. That is one of the best reading experiences of my life. You know, later on, Dan Simmons becomes kind of a fucked up Islamophobe, and I don't like that at all. But I can still read Hyperion, the whole series, and I just am totally moved by it. I just think it's some of the best writing ever. You know, and if you read his later work, just, you know, acknowledge the fact that some people, when they get older, they become shitty, reactionary people. So that's one book. Another book is Gaia's Garden. I just bought this permaculture book called Gaia's Garden, and I absolutely loved it. It changed my, totally changed my thinking on gardening. Other books, you know, Howard Zinn, People's History of the United States. What else? 10 books. I mean, from people I've interviewed on the Soulcast, I'd say Doug Gilbert, I Saw Fire. I still think he's one of the most inspiring people around. Scott Crowe, Black Flags and Windmills, for sure. Will Potter, Green is the New Red. Mackenzie Wark, Telesthesia, but really anything by Mackenzie Wark. Other resources I think people should check out. I mean, I can't stress it enough. It's Going Down is by far my favorite webpage as far as, like, you know, trying to take these anarchist ideas and forward the struggle and kind of demystify it so that it's not this subcultural thing, you know, that it kind of gets out of the anarchist quote-unquote ghetto and reaches people. And, you know, to someone who's in a place where there isn't a lot going on, I think there's a lot that can be done. I mean, especially with the election of Trump, I think it's really clear that people in more rural areas, actually, there's a lot you can do, you know. Figure out what the struggles are there. Figure out what people are pissed off about. You know, call for reading groups. You know, do little things to kind of throw up smoke signals to see who else in your area might be interested in what you're interested in, and work from there and get engaged or see what people are doing out there. You know, maybe there's a fucked up labor dispute at a mine. Maybe there's some logging shit going on. There's always, under this form, under capitalism, there's no shortage of places to intervene. So I would suggest starting there. Total disclosure, I actually punched back in because I took a look downstairs at what other books I have in my living room that I didn't mention later throughout this podcast. First, I just want to say Society of the Spectacle is probably my favorite book. It's had the most profound impact on me. I think everyone should read it, especially with Trump getting elected. Guy Debord was probably a fucking asshole. And I think there's a lot of problematic shit with how the Situationists handled their movement. But aside from his dictator-ish qualities, I still think his writings are amazing. And so on point, and so, you know, it's fucking sucks that dude is dead. Other books I would recommend, I'm just like going through my list here. Franco Berardi, Heroes. His analysis around mass killings and capitalism and its relation to ISIS, I think that's just fascinating, and I learned a lot from it. Also, Janet Beale's book about the life of Murray Bookchin, I learned a lot from that as well. That's a great book. Another book that has had a huge, huge, huge impact on me in the last few years is To Our Friends by the Invisible Committee. Now, this book is basically written as an intervention against activism and to people engaged in these movements. And I think it's critical reading for folks. The Other Shit by Takun and Invisible Committee, Introduction to Civil War, theory of Bloom, like all their shit. It's super fun to read. I mean, I love it as a poet, but that's my favorite shit these days. Other books I think people should read, The Dispossessed by Ursula Le Guin. It's a fiction book about an anarchist society, and there's a lot of, it's just really bleak. It's basically like the Animal Farm for anarchists. Another book that had a big impact on me is Collapse by Jared Diamond. You know, he just basically analyzes like why certain civilizations failed, and I learned a lot from that. Also along the same lines is Ronald Wright's A Short History of Progress, which I thought was also a great book. And other than those books, I think that another resource that I think is super critical is Crime Think's Critique of Democracy. I know like a lot of more syndicalist or organized people, you know, have a knee-jerk reaction to that critique, but I think it's valid. I think there's a lot of legitimate critiques to be made about democracy as if it's like the highest aspiration. Yeah, and also, of course, Submedia TV. But between, like, It's Going Down, Submedia, and Crime Think, I feel like, you know, you get a really good idea of what resistance movements are looking like in the country right now and how to intervene in a positive way. And the only other thing I'll say about this is just one comment on quote-unquote activism. It's a word that gets used a lot, and it's a word I don't really like. You know, if you want to get really specific, to me, when I think about an activist, I think about someone who's literally just trying to be active. And maybe they're not thinking so intentionally about how their interventions are actually having an impact. Like an activist would hold a sign in front of a building and expect the building to shut down. Whereas a revolutionary works towards taking direct action to see those changes happen or to build the culture that we need to enact those changes. Whereas an activist looks at other people as if they're people that need to be saved, as if they have the answers and their job is to go save them. Whereas, you know, a revolutionary, I mean, again, this is personal. This is kind of evolved from conversations I've had with Scott Crow and people like him. But whereas like a revolutionary looks and sees that all of our struggles are linked and that like I don't have the answer and you don't have the answer. And just because someone doesn't look like you or think like you, that doesn't mean that person doesn't have good ideas in that all of our liberation is linked. And so when we get out of this mindset that like, you know, you need to wake up, you need to see the light, you need to read this book, it's like, no, motherfucker, you need to fucking see the world through other people's eyes. You know, to change the world is to be changed by the world. So those are some thoughts on activism. But in general, you know, just get your hands dirty. Just start throwing darts against the wall and see what sticks. And don't worry about making mistakes. You're going to make a lot of them. I have. And that's just, you know, you never make any mistakes if you stay home. So, next question. Brian Eaton. How do you pick which creative endeavor to pursue? You know, I just follow my whims. That's the simple answer to that. I don't know how art works. I don't know what inspires me. I don't, it's a weird kind of magic and I don't actually have any control over it. I just go with what clicks and makes sense. And if I have to work too hard at something, I know that it's not working. So it's like the stuff with Pain One, it just happens instantly. And there are other collaborations where, you know, it's like, oh, I'm making this beat. This clicks instantly. And if I have to work too hard at it, then it's not clicking and it's not worth doing. So I don't do it. And because of that, I missed some opportunities. I've had a lot of chances to collaborate with bigger artists, but I just, I don't care. I don't care. I just want to do what's fun and inspiring to me. And so that's that. What's the best way to become more self... Another question from Brian Eaton. What is the best way to become more self-sufficient, both as an artist and as a person? I would say gardening, you know. We supply tons of our own food from our garden. It's been something I've been doing for about 10 years, and over the past 6 years, I've really, really, really dug in on it. You know, in our yard, we produce enough tomatoes to feed us all year. We produce enough, like, mints and tea stuff to make enough tea to last us the whole year. You know, I got a freezer full of lamb's quarter and carrots and, you know, pickled green tomatoes. And so I would say gardening, you know, especially when you're self-employed, it's a really good way to supplement your income, but it's also a really nice way to sort of get in touch with other forms of work, you know, the kind of work that feeds your soul, and brings you joy and takes you away from the bullshit hustling that actually, you know, is what most entrepreneurs have to deal with all the time, which is, you know, it's not much fun. It's not much fun having to fucking figure out a Facebook algorithm. It's not, I mean, I don't mind doing mail outs or shit like that, but I don't know. I like doing everything, but there's a bunch of bullshit involved with no matter what you're doing. So it's always nice to have that. Other ways to become more self-sufficient as an artist and a person. You know, I've really gotten into Tim Ferriss over the last couple of years. Someone put me up on the 4-Hour Workweek, and I listened to that audiobook, and there's sort of some schmucky things in there that I don't agree with, but there's a lot of stuff in there that really fits with an anti-capitalist perspective. So I would say, in general, if you're really serious about becoming more self-sufficient, I hate to say it, but I would say check out Tim Ferriss. I mean, I know a lot of people will be surprised to hear me say that, but I think he's great. I think a lot of his ideas are fucking great. It's about maximizing your happiness, maximizing your potential, not wasting your time. And there's just so much in there that you can learn from. And one of the things that he really says is to follow the things that bring you the greatest joy, because, you know, like, I mean, I've done this myself. I went out and I bought a 3D printer last year or the year before, and I was like, oh, I'm going to make 3D snow globes and I'm going to do this. And I was like, really? I didn't want to do that. I just did it because I thought I could make money from it. And then once I started doing it, I realized I fucking hate this 3D design shit. I don't want to fucking do this shit. So I think that's a good place to start. I would say listening to Tim Ferriss and really figuring out what it is that makes you happy and that you're good at, and doing it. And, you know, when you're thinking about things too much, shit doesn't get done. And sometimes you got to just let go and follow the things that make the most sense to you and just go with it. So that's my answer to that. How do I get through writer's block? I don't have writer's block. When I don't feel like writing, I don't write. What's one artistic medium that you would like to explore but haven't been able to? My podcast. I want to do more of my podcast. What's the process you take to make a large-scale, long-term project come to life? Like I said in the last question, I just dig in and I do it. I try not to think things through too much, because I think it was Clausewitz who said, you know, the best plans die on the battlefield. And I believe that. I believe, and that's one of the things about anarchist philosophy that really speaks to me, is, you know, you learn the road through walking. And when you think you have a plan, when you think you can figure it all out in advance, you're usually wrong. Since you've become increasingly DIY, what's the best piece of business advice you can give an artist trying to make a profit from their art? That's tough, because shit's so fucked up right now. But again, one of the things I learned from Tim Ferriss is this idea of the 80-20 principle, and that 80% of your income comes from 20% of your supporters. So isolating who your core audience are and catering to them, I think, is the easiest way to do it. But if you don't have a core audience, really just making quality shit and promoting the fuck out of it. You know, I look to people like Astronautilus or Chesky, you know, or even like independent artists, like my homies with Unicorn Riot. Like, you know, a year ago, they had just started an idea and were just going around doing what they wanted to do and live streaming shit. And then a year later, they're now one of the biggest media platforms or independent media that there is. So I mean, I would just say to just fucking do it and do it well and follow through and be consistent. What's a topic? Last question from Brian Eaton. What's a topic or theme you shy away from tackling in your art and why? That's easy. Love. And I guess because I think it's cheap. I think talking about love is cheap. I don't mean to offend any of my friends who sing about love. I think they do it well and they're awesome. But me personally, you know, I've been in a monogamous relationship with Yasmin since I met her in 2001. I don't even think I could begin to talk about how special a real awesome relationship can be. And I feel like to sing about it in a song, it just feels like cheap pandering to me. And I think that it's a kind of thing that you that's very private. And you know, of course, I mentioned my wife, and we make music together and all that stuff. But I just think it's not something I'm interested in really talking about. You know, I think it's also because we're very private people, and we don't we're not trying to be Kim and Kanye. I'm not trying to do some John Lennon shit. So I don't fucking talk about that. Again, I don't have a problem with people that do, but it's just, it's not something I'm interested in. It's something that I do. Okay, here's a question from Jason Jarvis. Jason Jarvis, my old friend from Portland, Maine. What up, Jason? All the anti-government and establishment stuff you're into, why not cast about the troubles that still exist in Ireland? Why not cast about the most corrupt government in the British ever? Well, I mean, first of all, when I criticize states, I am always criticizing the United States because I'm a citizen here, and I view that as the locus of all of a lot of the terrible shit in the world. You'll notice I very rarely criticize foreign governments. In fact, I'm hard pressed now to think of any time when I've criticized any foreign governments, whether it's Venezuela or Cuba or Russia or Iran or Iraq. You know, I focus most of my critiques at the United States because that's where I pay my taxes. And you know, I left the United States in 2004 to live in Spain, and I was like on some love it or leave it shit. And then I realized, like, shit, you know, it's a privilege to have citizenship in the United States. So if I'm gonna fight, I'm gonna fight there. So after Katrina, I came home. But, you know, I think the shit with Ireland, I'm actually pretty ignorant to it. I mean, I've heard a lot of fucked up shit. You know, I was reading this book recently about how, or called Settlers, about how, you know, during the Irish potato famine, people were so broke over there that they brought in workers from Ireland to, because they didn't want, they brought in workers from Ireland to dig out the swamps in the south because the black slaves on the plantations were so well trained and specialized that they didn't want to waste slaves digging out the trenches in Louisiana. And so they brought Irish people out to die digging these trenches, and they just kept them drunk on whiskey and money. And I think you know, it's I definitely take note of the fact that, you know, white people coming into this country throughout settlement times have had it rough as well. And you know, it's definitely worth noting, it's worth talking about and developing an analysis around, especially with the election of Trump, because people voted for him thinking he was going to solve their problems, that he was listening to them as white people. But if you look at the decisions he has made already about who he's putting in into power, it's clear the white working class is going to be more fucked over under Trump than under Obama. Okay, Dave Gulick, what are your thoughts on voluntarist philosophy and the non-aggression principle? How would you compare it to what you believe in philosophically? You know, I don't really know much about voluntarism. To me, it seems to me to be like an extension of the sort of whiter politics of libertarianism and anarcho-capitalism, and voluntarism seems like a more friendlier version of that. But to me, I just think anarchy really describes the world that I want to live in. That's voluntarist. And, you know, this whole idea of the non-aggression principle, you know, I've heard a critique of it where it's basically like, okay, if we're all going to agree to not be aggressive towards each other, what do we do when there is a factory up the block? There's no state. We don't have a state. And someone puts a factory up the block and it's leaking toxic fumes and toxic shit into the water and fucking up all of our shit. You know, how do we handle that? There's no police, there's no EPA. You know, I'll tell you how we handle it. We arm ourselves and we fucking take over that building and kick those people out. And that goes against the non-aggression principle. So I believe in self-defense, and I believe that, you know, a lot of like this like wishful thinking on behalf of like, you know, libertarians about, you know, free speech and live and let live, it's great, but we can't move beyond the system that we have now unless we're accountable to each other. But again, I'm pretty ignorant to voluntarism. If there's more stuff I need to learn about it, that's fine. But again, I mean, there's so many other offshoots like that, like Zeitgeist and all these other things. And to me, anytime people talk to me about those things, you know, I just want to say, you know, why don't look more into anarchy? You know, look at it through the long lens of history, you know, going all the way back to when people were hunter-gatherers, to how, you know, indigenous people lived, and, you know, various egalitarian projects that have existed throughout time. It, you know, that to me is way more interesting and more worth pursuing than these like random offshoots. But again, you know, Chuck Monroe, has anyone ever tried to refer to you as Zach Galifianakist? No, but I like that. I think I'll use that. Christopher George, what would your activism have looked like if Clinton won compared to Trump? You know, I think it would have been harder. I was thinking all along that Hillary was going to win, and that if she won, it was going to be good for leftist movements, quote unquote leftist, for radical movements, because people would see that the left, the quote unquote left, the Democrats have no answer. Now, Within a week of Trump being elected, it became very clear to me that that wasn't the case. So now we're organizing, you know, against a dystopia. So it actually has made organizing a lot easier. I think under Hillary Clinton, things would have been more difficult. You know, if Hillary had been elected, we'd be mainly, you know, I don't even know. We'd mainly be, you know, organizing against wars, and that's always hard to do. And so, yeah, I just think Trump's election has actually made activism easier because the stakes are so much higher. Bill Jackson, how about one for your longtime fans? What's your relationship like with all the old Anticon-related artists? With all of them? I am, you know, I talk to Pedestrian all the time. I just went to his wedding. Gel, I love Gel. You know, I still talk to Nostom every once in a while. I talk to Jim Jesus every once in a while. Others, not so much. What were the books and authors that completely changed your life? This is a question from Anthony Ballas. Completely changed my life. I would say starting with Malcolm X, The Autobiography of Malcolm X. That book radicalized me when I was like 12, and really just set me on a path of resistance. Whoever wrote Charlotte's Web, had a profound impact on me. You know, I became vegetarian when I was 11 years old because I just deeply empathized with those animals in that book. Other people who've had a profound influence on me: Emma Goldman, Anarchism and Other Essays. I would say Karl Marx, The Communist Manifesto, had a big impact on me. Howard Zinn, People's History, like I was talking about before. Noam Chomsky's 9/11 book was probably the first political book I ever read, and that had a huge impact on me. Since then, Slavoj Žižek, Violence. I think Žižek is a fucking fool. And, you know, the more famous he gets, the dumber shit he says. So I'm not gonna, you know, advocate for Žižek. But I think that, you know, his take on postmodernism and philosophy, it's really interesting a lot of times when he's not being a complete idiot. And of course, Guy Debord, or Guy Debord, Society of the Spectacle. I refer to that book all the time. I feel like anybody who hasn't read that book should read that book. It's such a great book. And Raoul Vanaheim, The Revolution of Everyday Life. Or Vanaheim, Revolution of Everyday Life. That's a book me and my wife, we read it on our honeymoon. And I just, you know, again, to go back to the love thing, you know, he says in that book, those who talk about revolution without realizing what's subversive about love have a corpse in their mouth. And I just think that's a great book. Those are some of the books that have changed my life, for sure. Let me see here. Nick Adams, how are you coping with the idea bringing a child into this fucked up world? I'm coping with it fine. You know, it's obviously, throughout my music, I've made numerous allusions to criticizing childbirth and people having kids. You know, I long associated it with mediocrity. Most of the people I knew who had kids just kind of gave up on. Again, I don't mean to be a dick as I'm saying this, but most of the people I know who had kids, they ended up sort of giving up on artistic stuff and focused more on survival stuff. You know, I think your motivations when you have children change a lot, and they say it changes you, you know, because it's like this beautiful, you know, thing that you can't really describe. And I'm really looking forward to that. You know, of course I thought, oh my God, like Donald Trump's being elected, I can't believe I'm having a fucking kid. But, you know, throughout the years, I've been meeting a lot of radicals who have kids and a lot of artists who have kids. And, you know, I take inspiration from them. You know, I don't know. I don't really know what my thoughts are on having kids. I'm trying not to overthink it. I'm just trying to, like, read and be present and not push, you know, push too hard on my kid to be something. But, you know, the way me and my wife are, I'm sure that this little motherfucker will do just fine in the world, if there is one. What is your favorite, question from Jake Reich. What is your favorite place to eat at on tour? Which city has the best vegan food? You know, I mean, to be honest, I'm just... okay, let me take a step back. My favorite place to eat on tour, I would say Portland, Oregon, Oakland, New York, and LA, just because it's so easy to find vegan food in those places. I like Red Bamboo in New York. I like Lotus Flower, or Lotus Leaf, or whatever, in Portland. I like in Oakland. I used to love this place called Taste of Africa that used to sell African food, Cameroon food, at the Oakland BART station, but that place isn't open anymore. But, you know, I mean, pretty much on the West Coast, you can just go anywhere and get amazing vegan food. Usually when I'm traveling, I don't make a big deal about it. I just Yelp whatever the closest vegan food is to the venue I'm playing at and just go and get Thai noodles is my go-to. So wherever there's dope drunken noodles, that's where I am. This is written in Arabic, so I don't know. But what is your take? I don't know what this person's name is, but what is your take on politics of other first world Western countries? Are they all as fucked as each other? I would say not really. I would say that from what I've understood through talking with various places, it's very different everywhere you go. You know, even in Europe, from France to Canada to Switzerland, I mean, they're all totally different and they're all fucked up in their own ways. Like, you know, I used to think, oh my God, Switzerland, I want to live in Switzerland. But Switzerland almost has this utopian, dystopian thing about it where, you know, it's fucking amazing and it's kind of at the top of where places I'd want to live. But at the same time, just the rise of fascism everywhere is scary. And I think in this like globalized world, we're just going to be looking at more and more. We're all more and more resembling each other. And that's really too bad. You know, when I first started traveling the world, things felt very different everywhere I went. But the more I travel, the more the coffee shop in France looks like the coffee shop in New York, looks like the coffee shop in Greece. But as far as politics go, yeah, we're all creeping towards fascism. And, you know, that's not inspiring. I'm really into French philosophy, and so I've really enjoyed getting to know radicals in France, spending time in Tarnac, and I just love that approach. And I think more people should look at what they're doing out there. I think it's super fascinating. And in the United States, we're fucked out here. We have a lot of work to do, and I look forward to getting to work on these things and to push things forward. And under Trump, it's just way more important now that people fight to win and take resistance seriously, and not as like a social, subcultural thing to pass time. It's going to be really important to move beyond where things are at now, and get fucking real and look at what happened in the 1920s, as far as like what the IWW is doing and looking at mass scale organizing. Black Panthers, etc. Joey Serrano, when is Deep Puddle coming back? Never. I don't know why people still ask this question. It's ridiculous. Yeah, I think Joey is kidding. I think he knows better. But yeah, it's just not going to happen. I mean, none of us knew each other when we made that record. We made that record in 1997. I mean, if it hasn't naturally happened in 20 years, then clearly it's not going to happen. So to anyone waiting for that, you know, don't hold your breath. Like, I have no interest in doing it, so it's not going to happen. And others don't either. Corge Finnerty. I think that's your name, Corge Finnerty. What do I think about QELD? QELD is an anarchist rap group from, I think, Bristol. And in general, I think they're fucking awesome. They seem like great people, and they have good politics, and I'm happy that there are other anarchist-minded rappers out there doing shit. You know, I would be interested to see what they would sound like over some different beats, over some weirder beats or more clubby beats. But in general, you know, I support their work, and I have never met them, but I look forward to meeting them, and yeah, much love to QELD. People who don't know who they are, go check their music out. Their new album, I think it's called Kush Zombies. Check them out, QELD. Laina De Pena. What would your tulpa be like? I don't know what tulpa is. Hold on, let me Google it real quick. Tulpa is a concept in mysticism of being or object which is created through sheer spiritual or mental discipline alone. I don't know, a black rock floating in a sea of plastic. I don't know. I'd have to think more about what tulpa is. I'm just glad I looked it up and it wasn't like another word for something vulgar. Okay, Abdul Razak. How is your mind state different going into a man's best friend project versus a regular album? Good question. Regular album, I'm usually thinking, okay, this has to be the next big thing. And that's where I'm coming from. When I make a Soul album or a DJ Payne 1 album or Soul in the Skyrider band, it's always like, okay, this is going to be my big album. I'm going to be touring off this for the next 2 years. You know, it's got to be great. You know, and so it's like usually a little more forced and intentional, whereas Man's Best Friend is always made from this space of like I'm in between projects and I'm just kind of fucking around, and it's It's more Kerouacian. It's more stream of consciousness. It's less intentional. And it's really just about capturing a moment and a feeling. And, you know, sometimes I just don't feel like doing shit like that. Sometimes I just want to make really overt, bombastic political shit. Or songs or whatever. And Man's Best Friend, usually they're not really songs. It's usually just like poetry. And that's, I like having an outlet for stuff like that. Another question from Abdul Razak. Is your wife Palestinian and what is her family like? Nope. My wife is half Iraqi and half, I don't know, white, English. And her family is cool. Her father's family, her mother's family is very much like mine. You know, they come from the Northeast, upstate New York. And, you know, they're just kind of just like my family, like quirky, not country folk, but people who, you know, are into gardening and all that kind of stuff. Now, her other side of her family from Iraq, you know, I haven't met a lot of them. They're Muslims. Some of them are still living throughout the Middle East. And I pretty much only know her immediate family, and they're all great people. You know, I think it was definitely a challenge for them to know that their beloved daughter was going to marry some loudmouth rapper. But, you know, after all said and done, we're cool as fuck. And I've learned a lot from them. And with my father being dead, I'm just glad to have them in my life. All right, let's switch the beat up real quick. I'm just kind of playing like weird samples off my doctor sample. Here's one from Ben Stringy Dunn. I want more Sage Francis and soul. Please make it happen. You know, I've done a lot of shit with Sage. You know, I'm sure I'll do more when the time is right. You know. Okay. Another question. And you know, I got much love for Sage. He's of all the people I've worked with, he's been so good to me and so loyal and you know, has really helped me a lot. Probably more than any other artists. Other than like Pat the Bunny or Chesky, Sage has really, really been there for me. So much love to Sage. Another question from Abdul Razak. How did you end up recording Slow Cold Drops and Banks of Marble? I think Pedestrian wrote both of them. Did anyone ever record a song you wrote but didn't record? No one has ever recorded anything I've written. Well, actually, I'm not going to say that. But yeah, basically, I mean, it's pretty simple. Pedestrian sometimes is able to write in my own voice better than me. So anytime he writes for me, I it's really easy. I just rap it. Another question from Abdul. How vivid are your dreams? You've wrote about many. Dream I had on my 25th birthday, one in Blood Oath, the one about Oakland being Afghanistan. You know, my dreams aren't that crazy. Usually I have vivid dreams when I'm like smoking weed for an extended period of time and then I quit. Then, you know, all the dopamine shit kicks in your brain, and when you're sleeping, it's just crazy. So that's usually when I have the most vivid dreams. I actually had a crazy dream the other night where I was like at Mackenzie Wark's house, and he had like a giant koi pond that was like a tidal pool in his yard, and I was like sitting on this bench in the pool as like this like tidal wave is hitting me, and then I was getting emails from Cory Doctorow, who I don't know at all, but Cory Doctorow is like wanting me and Payne One to come over and collaborate with him while we're on tour, and we were in Maryland as this was happening. So, but you know, I don't know, sometimes my dreams are vivid, sometimes they're just stupid boring shit about anxiety. It really depends. But as I haven't been doing a lot of weed lately, my dreams have been kind of boring. Another question from Abdul. How long were you thinking about, and how long did it take for you to write Deadliest Game? It felt like a therapy session. You know, Deadliest Game is a song I made years ago about video games, where I was just like name dropping a bunch of video games. I didn't think about it for very long at all. I just kind of woke up and wanted to make a pseudo viral video game song. Because at the time, like, nerd hip-hop, nerd rap was becoming very popular. And I was like, you know, I am a fucking nerd. You know, I play video games all the time. I just don't make a... it's not like a central part of my identity. So I wanted to make a song to be like, you know, hey, I got in fights in high school. I was in a shitty little gang. Like, I say fuck all the time. And hey, I love StarCraft and Civilization and shit like that. So it was really easy. It didn't take any time at all. Like all great art, anything I do that I think is good doesn't require any serious effort. Did you come up with the line? Here's another question from Abdul. Did you come up with the line in Terror in the Water? What came first, the ad or the article? What came last, the bullet or the factory? Yes, I did. again, that was like during a time where I was getting frustrated with media, and they were basically telling us, hey, unless you place an advertisement in our publication, we're not gonna write about you anymore. And as an independent artist, you know, that was fucked up to me back then, and so that's what I was thinking about. Joey Sullivan, what gear you use and why when producing instrumentals? My here's all the gear I use when I'm making beats. I first run everything through a Doctor sample, which is what I'm using right now. And then that's running through a chaos pad, so if I want to add more effects, I can do so. And then the chaos pad runs through a distortion pedal. And then the distortion pedal runs through a Memory Man delay. Put it on real quick. And then it's running through a little reverb pedal. I pretty much like to use electro harmonics, effects pedals. And then all that stuff runs through an old Fostex 8-track, which makes everything sound a little dirtier and thicker and muddier. And then that's running through this weird Rocktron compressor that I bought for $50 in Tucson. And then that's running through my Motu sound card, which I record into Logic, which I hate Logic. I like Digital Performer way better, but I just couldn't afford the new version of it. And then I'm using as a MIDI controller, I like using the Akai MPD-24 for when I'm like doing drum programming in Ableton. And then when I'm playing, I mean, I have a couple keyboards, but really when I want to make keyboards, I use my iPad mini, and then I have programs on there like the Mini Moog and Animoog and tons of keyboards in the in that iPad mini, and then I run it through all the stuff that you just heard. So all together, it's like... You know, one man Godspeed. Okay. Another question from Joey Sullivan. What do you like to cook? Man, I like to cook everything. In the winter, I really want to be cooking, you know, curries and stews, shit like borscht, chowder, etc. And then when it's nice out, I really like to just grill. I really like, for the most part, everything I make is usually sort of Cajun or African or spicy in some way. I really like spicy foods. I probably have like 6 different kinds of Creole. And one piece of cooking advice I would send to everybody is there's this place in LA called Spice Station. It's on Sunset Boulevard, and they literally have, you know, really great prices, but the top quality spices and spice mixes in the country. So if you're like, you know, a lazy cook like I am, you know, check out that website, call them up, ask them like what's new. You know, they have like habanero sugar and ghost pepper salt, and like, you know, I love making fucking hot chocolate with habanero sugar. You know, their Creole black Blackened Caesar shit. I mean, they just have so much shit there. It's fucking amazing. So if people are interested in cooking, definitely check out Spice Station. Who's my favorite new rapper? You know, I guess off the top of my head, I would say Milo. And I don't know if he's really new, but I just love what that guy is doing. It's so honest, and it's so original. And he just has such a unique voice. I don't know him, so I'm not getting paid to say that or anything. But yeah, I'm feeling what he's doing. Let me see here. Whew, man. I'm about halfway through these. Another question from Abdul. How often do you talk to your mom? Talk to my mom about 3 times a week. I always talk to my mom. And is my sister my only sibling? Yes, she is. Zach G. Shout out to Zach G. Zach, you know, Zach is a rapper. Check out his shit. He's on Twitter, TZachG, at TZachG. He's a good friend of mine. He grew up with Skyrider and Bluebird and all those folks. And he recently dropped his latest album called The Whole Tushy. And when he dropped his new album, you know, he's Jewish. When he dropped his new album, it was his Twitter account was hacked by Nazis. Everyone who follows him was blocked by those Nazis. Totally sabotaged his album and fucked his shit up. And you know, it just sucks. It sucks. And that's the kind of shit that's happening on like this micro scale to everyone under Trump, you know? So if you have homies who are quote unquote, you know, marginalized communities, you know, reach out to them and make sure they're doing all right, because you just never know, you know, all the petty aggressions that all the microaggressions happening against people, you know, I think you'd be surprised. But what happened to Zach was fucked up. So check out his new album, The Whole Tushy. It's a free download. And follow him on Twitter to make up for what the fucking fascist Nazis did to him when they sabotaged his account. Again, that's at TZachG on Twitter. You know, he's a shit talker, you know, but he's also a fucking great dude, and he's one of the smartest people I know. So shout out to Zach. His question: what are some changes you've noticed in your core audience over the years? Well, I think the main thing has been, you know, it's been a slow shift away from, like, people from the Anticon days and more towards political shit. And so people who have been coming to my music in the last decade are coming to it more based around politics and really don't know anything about Anticon. Whereas with the Anticon people, they're tolerating my politics and just wanting me to make Selling Live Water again. Again, that's a gross mischaracterization, but I feel like it's somewhat accurate. And you know, that's great. I mean, I have my favorite Guided by Voices albums and my favorite Godspeed albums, and I understand all that. But for me, you know, I don't give a fuck. I know what I want to do. I know what brings me joy and what I want to hear and what I think art is for. And I just feel just so grateful that I've continued to get support throughout all these years by following the shit that matters to me. Cause you know, if I'm gonna have to do some shit that I don't wanna do, I would just as soon go scrub toilets or you know, whatever. Sace, who produced Suicide Song and what inspired you to write it? You know, I think that song was inspired by a weird dream, and that beat was, but it's also a kind of, you know, actually when I think about it, that song is about kind of like dealing with fame. I was, you know, growing up, I wasn't like sought after by girls growing up in high school. And then all of a sudden, when I became mini famous around the early century, I all of a sudden had to kind of deal with like people wanting to know me and be friends with me, even though like they didn't really give a shit or know me. And so like dealing with like that was kind of a head fuck for me when I was younger. So that's kind of what that song's about. DJ Payne 1, do you like tomato? Yes, I love tomatoes. This year we had about, I don't know, 15 tomato plants. And, you know, some of them got bugs all over them, which is weird. I didn't even know there were bugs that got on tomatoes. But I actually like, I've kind of, become a green tomato fanatic. You know, I loved like making chutney from green tomatoes and pickling green tomatoes. Like lacto fermented green tomatoes is the shit. So to folks listening, if you are thinking about gardening or whatever, if you're gardening, don't throw away them green tomatoes. That's like, that's gold right there. But really what Pain One is doing is he's making a private joke about how frustrating it was in Europe because I swear all I ate on this last tour, I was so hungry. I was hungry for like a month straight. Every time I'd see somebody like, oh my God, have you lost weight? Yeah, motherfucker, I lost weight. I ate fucking zucchini, tomato, and rice for a fucking month straight. So to the lovely people bringing me out for shows in Europe, please, protein. It's something that is so essential for traveling vegan so that they don't get sick and drown in their own vegan tears. John Cutler, what do you think of UK hip-hop, in particular Jam Baxter and Edward Scissortongue? You know, I don't listen to any UK hip-hop. I've checked out the QELD, but I will definitely check these folks out, and, you know, I hope I like it. But for me, sometimes it's hard for me to listen to, like, British people with really heavy accents. I can't understand what they're saying. I mean, when I watch British TV, I have to have the subtitles on because I just can't understand what they're saying. I mean, I know it's ridiculous. I come from New England, but yeah, I literally, whenever I watch British TV, I have to have the subtitles on. Part of it's my own damn fault because I haven't managed to do a lot of touring in the UK for some strange reason. If there's UK bookers out there, hit me up. It's fucking bullshit. I don't know why, but I just never play the UK, so I never really interact with British people. So when I hear them talking, they might as well be speaking Russian. It's crazy. John Cutler, also Selling Live Water is one of my favorite albums. I'm aware you wrote about the significance of the song on the inlay card, but what was your inspiration for that album, in particular the Shoot the Messenger tune? Shoot the Messenger was straight up just Kerouacian stream of consciousness. I remember it very vividly. I went to a coffee shop on Shattuck. I had ordered a spinach salad, and I was just writing and drinking coffee. And yeah, I don't know. There was nothing about that song. It just, you know, again, like the art that I really enjoy that I make is the art I put the least amount of thought into, which is just crazy. John Cutler, who do you like to read fiction-wise? Well, I already mentioned Dan Simmons. I just read Octavia Butler, Parable of the Sower. People should read that. That is fucking amazing. That is the best fiction I've read forever. I pretty much can only read science fiction. If it's not science fiction, I don't give a shit. Arthur C. Clarke, the Rama series. It's like dense, but it's and dark and bleak as fuck, but that's great. Trying to think what else. It's been so long. The only fiction I've really been able to get into in the last few years has been Octavia Butler. A Werewolf. Any chance of another Deep Puddle Dynamics album? Nope. Here's a question from Jalda Bauth. Do you believe either in the collective subconscious and precognition? How do you feel about the idea that the anxiety we experience today by most people may be a precognitive phenomenon emergent from the collective subconscious in an apprehension of a dire near future catastrophe? You know, I'm an atheist. But I do think that there are things about our being that we do not understand. That's not like a cop-out. That's not my way of saying, oh, I have a soul. I'm going to go to a heaven that hasn't been described yet. I'm sure I'm just going to rot in the ground. Or I'm not sure, but I'm probably going to rot in the ground. And I don't think wishful thinking is really useful. But as far as precognition, you know, I got to say, I've had some precognitive experiences in my life where I've been thinking about something and then it happened. A couple of things come to mind. Like the first time was when I was like 12 years old and I was playing Zelda, and then I had a dream that I went into this forest and burned down a tree. And then the next morning I just went into this forest and burned down a tree, and there was a secret level to the level 7 second world there. And what was so weird is like there was no other point in the game where you used your candle to burn down a tree and find a dungeon there. And so the fact that I had that dream, like that fucked me up, made me think I was psychic. And I've actually, you know, when I was younger, I did a lot around the time of Selling Live Water. I did a lot of these experiments from that Stanford Research International developed about remote viewing and shit. And I lost my fucking mind. I totally lost my mind and had a total mental breakdown. So I've always just stayed the fuck away from that kind of thinking. You know, people want to do that shit, that's great. Collective subconscious though, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what I think about that. I wouldn't rule it out. I wouldn't totally flat out rule it out. But as far as apprehension of a dire near future catastrophe, I mean, in 100 years, this shit's fucking over. So, you know, you don't need some mystical shit to know that. But again, yeah, that's interesting. Okay, Lady Zen, do you ever feel like an old soul? Sometimes when I listen to new hip hop, put it that way, but not really. For the most part, being involved in activism and being a performer, you know, I'm around young, like, you know, people who are 20, 18, you know, young people, quote unquote, young people all the time. And, I very rarely even think about age, just because I'm meeting so many young people who are so fucking smart that I don't even think about it. You know, there's people I've been hanging out with, like, oh my God, you're fucking 22. Like, holy shit, you know? So yeah, no, not really. I mean, sometimes when I think, oh my God, I'm almost 40, like that makes me feel old, because it's like, fuck, you know? My father died when he was 57. So it's like, shit, you know? Better live it up. Decomposure. What are three questions you wish people would stop asking you? Number one, deep puddle. Number two, anything about Anticon. And number three, I don't know. Let me think. Yeah. I don't know. Last one, 1, 2, 3. What is your favorite statement ever heard in a song? Pat the Bunny. If singing changed anything, they'd make it illegal. Actually, pretty much everything Pat the Bunny says on his last few solo albums, there's just so much, like, just sharp critical commentary in there that you know, I just love it. And what's ironic is that is as he is, like, you know, abandoning anarchism, he's coming out with all this brilliant thinking, and I think that's awesome. Ty Schuster, do you use amendment in your soil or follow a no-till method? Well, up until now, I've used amendment. I use this mushroom compost and compost that from our bin, but to be honest, our compost hasn't been that productive because I had a really big compost a couple years back, and it produced a lot, but like raccoons were getting into it, and then the raccoons wanted to be closer to the compost, so they actually moved into my basement and had a family of raccoons, and then my Yorkie got trapped in the basement with the raccoons. So I had to dead that shit. But ever since I've been reading permaculture, I actually just sheet mulched all my beds. So anyone who's seen pictures of my garden in the past, I had all beds in there. This year, like in the fall, after I read Gaia's Garden, I pulled up all the beds and sheet mulch them all. Now, sheet mulching is a process where you put down cardboard, paper, organic matter, sticks, leaves, etc., up about in compost, about 6 inches high. And so I did that all over my garden. And so I'm going to a no-till garden based on permaculture principles next year. And that's something I'm fucking really excited about. That shit is just fascinating to me. I'm probably going to document some of it and do some more stuff on permaculture. To what extent, I'm not really sure. But it's fun as fuck to learn that stuff. Panda Watch 29. If you could change one thing in this world right now, what would you change? Honestly, you know, I would abolish the state and end capitalism and have everyone instantly, you know, awake in this egalitarian utopia where they are pursuing the things that matter the most to them and dedicating their time, you know, to those things. Now, of course, if we were to abolish capitalism in the state right now, it wouldn't look like that. You know, we see what the fascists are doing. We see the reactionary views held by a lot of people. We see how fucked up and selfish and individualist so many people are. We've got our work cut out for us. But, I just want people to be happy. I just want people to live in a world where they're not getting fucked over. And they're not fucking other people over, you know? Let's see. Hip Hop is Alive FM. Do you have expectations or goals for fatherhood? You know, my only goal is really trying to be a stay-at-home dad. And that's a huge part of why I'm trying to shift the economy of what I'm doing away from touring into being just more creative, because I think one of the biggest problems, you know, when I think about patriarchy and what it means, I think about, like, you know, the generation of fathers that came before and the generation of fathers that came before that. You know, they're just these men who just fucking worked all the time, and they thought that that's like all they had to offer was money. And as a result, you know, they weren't present. They lived their lives that way. And as a result, they're like stressed out and abusive. I'm speaking from personal experience. And so that's pretty much like my only goal, is to not be that, you know, to figure out how to be a positive role model, to be present, and to be a positive male role model that's not putting forth the kind of shitty male models that we've seen. And beyond that, it's like, you know, I'm of course I would love it if my kid grew up to be, you know, Malcolm X or something, but, you know, I'm not going to push my kid to do anything other than what he wants to do. Concerns? I mean, those are my concerns. You know, of course I'm concerned about sending the kid to school, you know, the fucking influence of the outside world, there's no shortage of things to be concerned about. I mean, especially considering how old I am and how I tend to overthink things. I'm concerned that I might not be able to provide, you know? I mean, I'm sure I will, but it's like, you know, the same fucking shit everybody worries about, I guess. But in general, I'm just super psyched about it. I feel like me and my wife, we're in a really good space. You know, we own our home downtown Denver. You know, she's working part-time, and you know, it's like, I in general, other than being like a millionaire for nothing, I couldn't imagine better conditions to be having a kid right now. So I'm pretty psyched. Okay, last question. House and Sasa, do you think we can make it, or is humanity already fucked up concerning climate change and social justice? You know what? I definitely think we can make it. And that's not like some faux fucking hope bullshit, but in general, that there's a quote, history, the arc of history bends towards justice. And then I saw another quote that says, you know, the arc of history is fleeing repression. And you know, when you look at the world through like this from a vast lens, the pendulum swings. You know, right now the far right looks like they're about to take over the world, and we might be in for some really dark times. But through those, sometimes things have to get really bad in order for them to get better. And I genuinely, honestly think that we're gonna see mass movements pop up over the next few years, you know, unlike anything we've ever seen. And people in general reject this ugliness. They reject being oppressed. They reject being exploited. And articulating that, framing that, organizing from there, and building from there, and getting outside of our bubbles, like, it's the only chance that we're gonna have. And in general, it's like, let's just say everything goes to shit and everybody dies, you know, and humanity starts over. That's gonna be better for the Earth. So regardless of what happens, the Earth is gonna be fine, and humanity will not vanish from the Earth. We'll be back, and hopefully we learn our lessons. And with that, I'm out of here. This was fun. This is a weird way to spend a Friday afternoon, but I kind of enjoyed it. And if people wanna support this project to keep it going, to help me expand it and do new things with it, please consider backing me on Patreon. It's patreon.com/soulone. And peace.
Yeah.